Stanislav Lem, Solaris. An introduction written in 2002 for a German language edition of Solaris from Heiner Verlag in Munich, in which it appeared in translation. First published in 1961, Solaris appeared in an English translation in 1970. It was a revelation to us in America, not only of a brilliant book, but of a science fiction writer who we now learned was immensely popular in his native land and well known throughout Europe, but of whom most of us knew nothing. Stanislav Lem? We knew the acronym LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, a wonderfully apt name for a writer of science fiction. And Solaris was clearly the work of a master of his art. Several other Lem novels were soon translated into English, among them the marvelous Eden, and were well received critically. In 1973, Lem was made an honorary member of the Science Fiction Writers of America, but this was in the clammy depths of the Cold War, and many members of the association disapproved strongly of admitting a citizen of a communist nation. Apparently it made no difference to them that Lem was a Pole, not a Russian, and that his books could be read as containing a cogent and subversive critique of Stalinist aims. The whole thing became a tiny cause célèbre. A magazine poll of science fiction authors on the question of the Vietnam War showed them split half and half into hawks and doves, and the division over Lem followed much the same lines. There was great fulmination on both sides, to which I contributed. Finally, the officers of the SFWA, citing a technicality, withdrew Lem's honorary membership. Having assumed a lofty moral stance, I was trapped in it and felt I must refuse the Nebula Award voted me by the members of the SFWA for a story which was, all too ironically, about intellectual and political oppression. That the award, therefore, went to the runner-up, Isaac Asimov, a vociferous cold warrior, perfected the irony to an almost Lemmian degree. For many Americans, Tarkovsky's film, Solaris, released in 1972, unfortunately eclipsed the book itself. It is a thoughtful and beautiful film, but I do not think it equals the intellectual breadth and moral complexity of the novel. Isaac Asimov, a vociferous cold warrior, perfected the irony to an almost Lemmian degree. And indeed, though Lem enjoys giving us dramatic descriptions of the strange shapes and constructs created by the planetary ocean of Solaris, suggesting the unearthly galleries of Piranesi and the Borgesian perspectives of Escher, the book resists filmic interpretation, since, in essence, it is not conceived visually or even sensually. It is, above all, a work of the mind, about the work of the mind. Rereading the novel, I saw again how immediately one perceives it as a genuinely serious work of science fiction in the tradition of the older masters of the form. Lem resembles Jules Verne in the audacity of his invention and in a certain stateliness or aloofness of style, even when narrating in the first person. He is like H.G. Wells in his alertness to where the cutting edge of science lies at the moment, and to the social implications of his fable. Like both Verne and Wells, he is a shamelessly good storyteller, using all the tricks of withholding and revealing information to keep the reader in suspense. His ambition to produce a literally universal parable is reminiscent of Olaf Stapledon. In his perceptive afterword to the 1970 American edition of Solaris, Darko Suvin, one of the very few critics writing in English who were capable of appreciating Lem at the time, makes perhaps the most revealing literary parallel, calling the novel a variation on the 18th-century conte philosophique. The term is precisely descriptive and offers a useful approach to the book. Yet the clear, amused gaze of a Voltaire is not how Lem sees his universe. His narrative promptly establishes an atmosphere of confusion, mystery, tension, suspense. The opening chapter, The Arrival on the Planet Solaris, is full of shocks, hints, glimpses, apparent hallucinations, unexplained events, enigmatic behaviors. The gradual, eventual development of the implications of these riddles throughout the book will offer the reader, just as a detective novel does, the profound and simple satisfaction of understanding, of solving the puzzle. But all such solutions remain, as it were, held in solution, for the explanations serve only to offer hints and glimpses of further mysteries on a deeper plane. The novel is an exhibition of the inability of human understanding to achieve a final stage of knowledge. Perhaps it implies also that human understanding, at best, can understand itself, but nothing outside itself. An early adept of cybernetics and information theory, Lem created in Solaris an extremely sophisticated narrative structure for exemplifying the frustration of the desire to understand. Dense, vivid, explicit, packed with implications, the words of his story lead us through tumultuous, suggestive, successive images to theory after theory, question after question, only to arrive at last at a word-constructed but wordless silence. One element of this pursuit will delight anyone who has had to read much of what is called academic research. To such a reader, the hitherto unknown field of solaristics will be all too familiar. Lem's sarcastic wit is at its sharpest as he goes through the library of solaristics. The claims of the experts, the quarrels of the scholars, explanations that replace explanations ad infinitum, theories that jostle one another into oblivion, he has it all in a few brilliant pages. Satire in the mode of Jonathan Swift, philosophical fiction in the mode of Voltaire, and science fiction in its parable mode are all likely to offer us more light than warmth. Seeking general truths about humanity, they must forego the irreducible recalcitrance of human individualities from which other fictions draw their vitality. These narrative modes also tend to gender themselves strongly as male. They may denigrate women. They may include them as stereotypes, perceived as existing only in relation to the male characters. They may omit them altogether. All this was nothing unusual in literature, with the exception of the novel, in the 18th century and all the centuries before it. And all too often, by creating a future for only half of humanity, science fiction narrowed the intellectual and moral potential of the genre till it could be dismissed as a set of naive adventure stories for boys. The scientists and scholars of solaristics in the library seem all to have been men. The present crew of scientists, stationed on Solaris, consists of men. So, evidently, did all previous crews. In a serious fiction written in the late 20th century, to establish an intellectual realm that includes no women at all is to imply a statement by omission, intentional or not. The reader may legitimately wonder if the intellectual realm is somehow established by the exclusion of women. Will it collapse if women are admitted? Is that the implication? There is nothing naive about Lem. Solaris provides a unique and peculiarly interesting example of the womanless universe. For there is a woman at the center of the book. She is absolutely a key figure, and though she is essentially passive, her action proves decisive. Yet she does not exist. Not only was she the wife of the protagonist, Kelvin, but she is far more indissolubly part of him, more absolutely his, than a wife can be, even a dead wife. A creation of the enigmatic Solaris ocean, Rhea is a figment, a simulacrum, constituted from Kelvin's memories. She is capable of thought and choice up to a point, yet her seeming existence is altogether dependent on his existence. and she is literally, appallingly, unable to exist apart from him. What kind of love is it, then, that grows in him for her? We learn that he allowed her to kill herself once in real life. Now, if she tries to kill herself again, and again? What is the function of these powerful moving scenes, this pattern, in the narrative? What has this relationship, or is it an autism, to do with solaristics, or with the quest for final meaning? Has Rhea's sacrifice any necessary connection to the ultimate glimpse of fragile, tentative redemption Kelvin attains at the end of the book? Or can he attain it only once the disruptive feminine element is out of the way, and the universe can be reduced once more to the play of pure, genderless, that is, masculine, mind? To some readers, this may be the most fascinating problem of the book, even more fascinating than the paradoxical questions it poses openly, teasing us with its dense and marvelous imagery, goading us to distrust all information, leading us through hallucination to vision which may itself be delusion. To ask questions which must be asked yet cannot be answered, to create images which can be neither forgotten nor explained, this is the privilege of the most courageous artists.